If there's something I need, I don't already have. I know I'll get it from a good friend. If there's something I need, I don't already have. I know I'll get it from a good friend. Hi, everybody. It's Jamie Lee Curtis, and you're listening to the Good Friend Podcast, presented to you by iHeartRadio. It's a podcast about friendship. We talk about everything. We cry, we laugh, we think about what it really means to be a good friend. And I have conversations with some of my best friends, some people I've never met, and sort of everything in between. So I hope by the end of it that you have a really good sense of what friendship means to me and the people that I consider friends. And I hope you can take those same ideas into your own friendship groups. And I hope you enjoy it. The really beautiful part about this, Amanda de Cadenet, is that we don't know each other. The beauty is not ever physically been in the same space.
I know, but we have shared spaces in a very powerful way together through mutual friends and common goals. That is so powerful when you get to meet someone with an open heart and the same intentions and focus in life.
I know, but it's what it really solidifies for me is that friendship is not just both of you smoking a joint, you know, out of a apple that you turned into a bong when you were 14. That is not the only way you can make a friendship. You can make a friendship in friend groups with common links, common intentions, common life goals. Goals. I want to be alive and open, and you want to be alive and open. And
I do.
Therefore, I am in you. You are in me. We feel close to each other, even if we didn't smoke pot out of an apple bong.
Apple bong when we were 14. But I think we would have had a lot of fun doing that still.
Yeah, I don't know. I was very excited. My listener will be very excited that we're talking today. I know I have at least one. I actually know who that person is who's probably listening. So I just don't feel like such a loser that there's no listener. And I don't get grandiose thinking that there are thousands. I just go into there's one. I think you would have terrified me.
Why?
In high, like if we had met in our youth. I mean, I'm older than you, so we would have never met in our youth.
We can imagine what we would be like.
Right. So since we are not friends in that conventional sense, we don't have a shared history. No. So I'm going to do a little unpacking with you to sort of talk about your history as a friend. But the times we have been on Zoom calls with our mutual friends, with our mutual goals for social justice, women's rights, the election, many common links.
Yes.
What I have learned from your life history is that you were a wild child from early on. Yes?
Yeah, I was. That was the first label that was put onto me.
Oh, I don't even know what label. I just made that up knowing that you were sort of out on your own.
That was a label. Of course, you intuited that without even knowing it. But when I was 14 years old and I was hosting a live late night talk show and I had a very severe drug and alcohol addiction at the time. And what goes with that, as you know, is a lot of behavior that is loud. And in my case, it was visible because I was on TV at the time. So people were looking at what I was doing. And that was a name, Wild Child, that the British tabloid media gave me.
I wouldn't know that because I didn't know that about you.
I know, but of course that was something you intuitively picked up because that was actually, I was a kid and I was, you know, I was definitely out in the world doing things that kids should not have been doing.
So let me stop you I'm just going to literally unpack this for a minute. So
because I know nothing, I don't Google, this isn't, we're not selling anything. If you had a book, I wouldn't have read it before this, because I don't want this to be about that. I want this to be authentic and between
us.
That's
what I do on my pod. When I interview people, I don't talk about their project. There's enough other places to do that.
Yes. And that's not a part of this. It was never an intention of this. It was simply to explore friendship, good friendship in the realm of a podcast with me as a sort of connective pivot.
And thank you for asking me to be a part of this.
I wanted to. I respect you.
Thank you, Jamie.
I want to know kind of how you became this person and how long you've been that person, because I wasn't that person originally. I was much shallower and very insecure. But I'm interested in most people when they're 14 are in friend groups. They're in some sort of organized school life. They haven't even often started to explore themselves as a individual thinker, beer, experiencer in the world, certainly physically. We're just at 14 trying to figure it out. I mean, 14, 15, oy. So to hear that you were a young woman at 14 with a late night.
I know, crazy.
So how formed were you and what formed you?
It's interesting that you say that you don't feel that you were the person that you are now. The roots of the integrity and the value system, which I know you hold so dearly, it's one of the things that I respect about you, that you feel like that wasn't necessarily part of
that. That probably was. I was talking more about the confidence,
okay,
knowing my mind, knowing what I
yeah, you know what I mean? I just wanted to bring, like, I can't imagine that it wasn't, actually, because there's no way that you build the self that you have built, or I build the self that I have built, no matter how long the detours were, without having those pieces of me as an integral building block. I think I've always been an advocate for justice, and it showed up in very odd ways. When I was at school, for example, where I got in a lot of trouble because as a 13, even a 12-year-old, I would say, why are you punishing someone and giving them a detention because they don't wear knee socks, which is the school uniform? They're wearing ankle socks. Who cares? What does that have to do with their ability to be productive at school? Why are you punishing people unnecessarily? Punish people when the punishment does not fit the crime. And I got in trouble at school for saying things like that, you know, and they were like, Amanda's disruptive and she's getting kids to think, you know, all these bad ideas. And it was like, well, not really. I'm just questioning the system that you've got going on here because I don't agree with it.
How have you questioned the system since you were young? Because did you come out questioning the system within your family unit within those early years?
So my dad is a race car driver. And what that showed me growing up, number one, was that he didn't, and I have a brother who's 2 years younger than me. So he never treated us based on gender. He taught me to ride a motorbike when I was 6 years old. He always said to me, I don't want you to have to get on the back of some guy's bike. You learn how to ride a motorbike. And you'll tell him, no, you get on the back of my bike. He had female race, his co-pilots in some of his races. He raced at Le Mans every year, which is a 24-hour endurance race, where you'll race for like 10 hours straight at like 270 miles an hour. He had female co-pilots. So I grew up with this concept that, you know, as a woman, there was no restrictions because of my gender. And what a shock I got to realize that was not the case. And I was always told to chat, to ask questions, always told to ask questions by my parents. They always said to me, just because someone says that's the way it is, do you think it's the way it is? And why do you think it's the way it is? Or why do you think that's not the way it is? And, you know, interestingly enough, even with my kids now, when they go to the doctor, they're now 14, my oldest one's 28, they're old enough to go in by themselves now, right? And so I'll say, you ask questions. If they're telling you this, you ask why. If they're making a suggestion of like, well, we think you should take this medication, ask them, why do you think I should take that medication? What are the side effects? What's the pros? What's the cons? And I think empowering kids, as I was empowered to ask questions, has always led me to create, you know, a different path where I haven't seen one.
Okay. I want to get to kids because, of course, having you as their mother, as a friend of theirs, as well as their mother, is going to help. But I want to go back to school for a minute. I was such a good girl and never asked any questions ever of anyone. I was raised in a house where you were told if you ask for anything, that is a sign of weakness, that you need nothing.
Because you need something, right.
Need nothing and no one, follow the rules. The rules are there for a reason, follow them. And I was the ultimate good girl. I never said no to my mother.
Wow.
Never said the word no. I remember the day my four-year-old daughter said no to me.
What did you do?
And I remember I sort of started hyperventilating. Like, wait a minute, what do you mean no? I also was raising my daughter differently. I was encouraging her to have a voice. So it wasn't an accident that when I said, let's do something or we're going to do this or whatever, I don't even remember what it was. It's irrelevant. But she said no. Yeah. I remember sort of quivering, like, what? So what I'm bringing up to you is it's you would have been an example to me. I would have sat, I would always sitting in the front row, always did what I was supposed to do, never did anything wrong, ever. So I would have looked to you like you were James Dean you would have been unapproachable.
Isn't it sad that when we think about, you know, what that version of me would be at that state at that time, it's James Dean. Like, who's the woman?
I understand. I'm telling you, you would have seemed like the rebel without a cause. You would have represented to me something so foreign. And I think that's it. It would have been, you were speaking the way you just described. Well, why can't we wear our knee socks this way? I wanted to belong so much. And what's interesting to me is I'm not getting a sense. You see, so my need to belong made me reach out to a certain group of friends and find them and cling to them because that meant I was part of something and I was in a group and we were good people. Do you know what I mean?
Like, were you an only child?
No, I have an elder sister who was a little bit of a rebel. But no, I just was raised by a strict businessman. And, you know, I just didn't challenge authority on any level.
Have you grown up to challenge authority?
It has taken me, I'm 62, it's taken me a long time. I am starting to, simply in getting involved in social justice, you can't get involved with social justice issues and not challenge authority because it is the authority.
That's the issue.
That has is the issue often.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to something because I would have looked at you like you had grown, you know, weird antlers. I would have looked at you like, how does she have that? Now, when you were young, did you have friends who were with you in that? Like, I'm trying to figure out you as a friend. You seem like somebody who was sort of out in front a bit. And did you have a lot of friends in your early life like that?
I mean, it was hard to find people that could understand my life because there were not other 14-year-olds that were hosting a live late night talk show who were not in school in the way I was. I was earning a lot of money, which was good because I was self-supporting. But I had a very unusual life. And then at 16, I was 16, almost 17, I met my first husband. So, and I married him and had a daughter by 19. So I would say my entire teenage years were not usual. There are a lot of teen moms, but I was a teen mom who was on TV, who was a household name as a young woman who was trying to form her identity. And I had a husband who was a successful musician, who's in a band called Duran Duran, which I did not know at the time. I was into kind of punk music, so it wasn't really my world, but I suddenly entered his world of like marrying an international pop star when I was, you know, 17. And so I had a very unusual life, and it was hard for me to find people who I could connect with on that path. But one of the things that I've always felt as a strong part of me is that I connect to the essence of people. I know, and I've known from a very young age, and maybe it's because I grew up around people who had, you know, unusual jobs. My dad was a race car driver. I was surrounded by musicians. My dad's closest friend is in Pink Floyd. You know, I grew up around like, you know, Dire Straits and Pink Floyd and the Stones, and like that's the people I grew up around. And so I always knew from a young age that what you saw on the outside was not necessarily what was happening on the inside. Mm-hmm. And I've always been able to connect with people through their essence and my essence. And so even though the outsides of my life were very different in my teenage years, I've always had friends also who had sort of nothing to do with my life. They were random people who I met on a bus, or someone who I met in a line somewhere, or just like random choice, you know, like the universe. Somehow I'd meet this person and I would have so much in common with them. But on the outside, we had nothing in common. But on the inside, it was like, oh, I know you and you know me. And those have, a lot of my teen years were friends like that. If there's something I need, I don't already
have. I know I'll get it from a good friend. We'll be right back with more Good Friend after this quick break. So stick around.
You said you had a child very young. It's so funny when you were talking about you in school early. I went to a girls' school for 2 years.
So did I. Did you like it?
Not in Los Angeles, did you? No, you were
in England. No, in England. I went to boarding school.
Yeah, no, this wasn't a boarding school. Yeah, I liked it. It was. I
only
grew
2 years.
I went to Beverly Hills High for a year, and then I went to Westlake School, which is a girls' school, for a couple years, and then I went to a prep school back east for a year because I followed my mother. Anyway, my point is, so my junior year at Westlake, we could take our yearbook pictures in our friend groups rather than just the traditional.
Ooh, that must have felt like pressure.
Well, it felt fun and a little different than just the classic ugly picture of you. And so, you know, the arts kids, you know, wore top hats and were very flamboyant. The ballerinas were together on point. The jocks were there with their hockey sticks or whatever. And I was a cheerleader. And so my friend
group.
You were
a cheerleader?
Oh, totally.
Oh, come on.
No. I mean, come on. Of course, I was a cheerleader. Because that's what I do. I cheerlead. So our group was, we were sitting with our legs crossed in a semicircle with our hands in our lap, wearing our uniforms, kind of smiling. But there were four girls. The only rule at Westlake that I remember was you're not allowed to leave campus without permission. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just the
rule.
That makes
sense.
Right. There was a picture in the yearbook of four girls walking off of campus, taken from the back. So it was their backs to the camera as they walked out the gate of the school, which to me was you.
Totally.
When you were talking about, you know, like, why can't you wear
ankle
socks?
Was me. And that was me. And I would be like, and why aren't you coming with me?
Right. And I jump. But see, I wouldn't have known you then because you would have scared me because I was such a good girl. I started to explore who I was more in my 20s. My 20s, I was an actor at that point. You know, I was starting to expand myself a little bit. And you were a mom in your 20s?
Mom. I was a mom. I've been a mom most of my life.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting because since you and I have become friends, you know, obviously it's, you know, you've been on my, I've seen more of you in my Instagram feed. And I wonder if, you know, they're listening to me because they know that I'm like talking to you on the phone and then suddenly there's like, you know, Jamie images in my Instagram feed or something. But I've been really had so many clips and films and little bits and pieces that I've seen of you. And my husband was saying to me the other day, we were looking at something and a photo of you came up on my feed and he was talking about how like, you know, foxy you were. And not were, I mean, I'm not saying he hasn't seen you today. I think you're foxy today. But my point being is that when I started looking at all those things, I was like, oh my God, your sensuality in your 20s and your sexuality, you know, and just like this, just gorgeousness, you know what I mean? The way you walked and moved and everything. And it's like, and I'm listening to you talking about how you were a good girl who just followed the rules. And yet when I think about the imagery of you that I've come to know of late, especially, that is not what I would have thought.
Yeah. But it very much was the case. I did not have any of that big sophistication and I clung to my friends, you know, my early high school friends. And then for me, what happened is that I became a professional at 19 and all of my friends were 30. Every single person was 10 years older than me. Everybody.
Right.
So all of my friends were going to frat parties and I was paying taxes and hanging out with 30-year-olds and 32-year-olds and 33-year-olds. So I grew up.
I had that experience too. I think that was similar. Because when you start working young, it's true. You get put into a work environment where you're around people who are generally, you know, older than you when you're a young person who's working, and that becomes your community. So you start learning and getting exposed to things that you wouldn't if you were 19, right?
Right. And I grew my mind from those years. Like I really learned the practical aspects of life. My good friends taught me how to cook, how to keep a house.
Because a lot of that isn't intuitive as well. Like for some people it is, but you know, I had a friend when I moved to LA, I was 19, my daughter was 20, my daughter was a year. And I had a friend called Priscilla, who was Priscilla Woolworth, incredible woman, I don't know, 15 years older than me. And she had one daughter the same age as me, one who was 2 years older. And she taught me very basic things that I did not know how to do. Like, how to keep a house functioning. You need to order like washing up liquid. And this is how you cook. She taught me how to make basic foods like spaghetti bolognese and a green salad with a great dressing. And she taught me so many things that today I still rely on.
Yes. My friend was Susie Pratt, who was an actress on a TV series, and she was married and she was 20. I was 19, she was 21 or 22, and she was married and keeping
very grown up.
Marriage, very grown up. And she had been raised in a restaurant and, you know, the garlic. Like, yeah. I was like, garlic? I have no idea what garlic is. I had no, I was a white bread, you know, white bread, peanut butter and jelly kind of a girl. I did not cause a stir at all. So my development and my friends, I clung to these older friends of mine, and I can mark throughout my life the sort of water lines on me that all of these women filled me to that point.
Oh, isn't that so beautiful that actually in my book, which I'll send you if you're ever just like bored and want a fun, you know, read, you can just read one chapter at a time, but.
Or maybe that I would be very interested in reading and maybe I'll take with me when I'm going my trip.
Okay. I'll put that in a little care package for you.
Thank you.
There's a whole chapter on friends because the chapter is actually about how my friends have helped grow me, nurture me. At different times, they've mothered me. They've been sisters, partners. They've just taught me so much, and they've helped me to grow into the woman that I am. And then I also talk about the heartbreak of breaking up with friends, and that it's not to be underestimated. It's like one of the most devastating things to have a friend break up when you truly, if it's a long-term friendship or someone that you have, you know, multiple connections with over many years, and you realize, oh my God, have we outgrown each other? Mm-hmm. And then you have to handle that. You have to allow for that. And then it's been heartbreaking for me when I've had to let go of friends because they're my chosen family.
We'll be right back with more Good Friend after this quick break.
Letting go of friendships, obviously, it's a podcast about friendship. And, you know, people have talked about toxic friendships. I refer to some people as vampires, where I do feel that it is an unhealthy relationship, where I feel that they're stalking me in a way or watching my every move.
Single white female vibes?
A little bit. Where I do feel, I get this feeling like, whoa, I have a boundary. It is me, and I don't want you to comment on everything that happens. And if I post anything, I get an immediate cut.
Oh, I've seen that as well. I've seen that with certain friends of mine that have friends of theirs that are like the first to comment on all of their posts. And you're like, why are you so up in her shit? You know what I mean? Like, yes. Back up, you know,
like back up.
You really need the world to see that you're so intimately connected with this person. It's generally a person who has a profile or has like a certain amount of followers where you see those kind of like those certain friends who are like filling the comments time and time and time again. You're like, we get it. You're friends with her. We know, you know?
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to be careful in my friendships because I want to have a sort of wide-ranging group of friends and be able to have, as we are public people, be able to have private lives and private friendships. It can cross-pollinate sometimes in a way that gets a little icky. But you brought up, you know, breaking up a friendship. It's a hard experience to acknowledge that you have moved on from someone. Now, some people just do it passively.
I was going to say the way in which we do it, I think, is really important.
Right. So the classic avoidant way is to just stop
contacting them.
Contacting them. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't respond to texts. That is okay. That is the avoidant way. I also feel like it's unhealthy. And I am going to have a judgment on this one, because I feel most people don't want to be ghosted. That's what it is. It's ghosting. Whether you go on a date with someone, you're like, man, not for me. And you don't want to go on another date with them, or whether you are wanting to take space from a friendship or whatever it is. I do feel like even a minimal amount of communication, just to let that person know so that they're not wondering and stuck in their head and imagining all these crazy reasons of why it is. You can just let them know, hey, you know, thank you so much. Wish you the best. That's it. You know, you can do it in a way that sounds very blunt, but I was trying to think of, you know, if I haven't been on a date with anyone so long, so I don't even know what I would do. I think I'd be incapable of going on a date, but certainly with friends, I think. And I actually have a situation with one of my dearest friends right now where we were in the midst of that negotiation. And I think about it every single day, because the next response is on me. And I've been sitting on my response for months. And every day that goes by that I don't respond, I think, oh my God, another day's gone by. This is giving her the message, you don't care about the friendship, because you've not responded to her for, you know, 2 months. I'm getting on to 3 months now. And every day I think I must respond because I care about this person. And I'm afraid to because I've let it go for so long. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm in the middle of one right now. And it's, even though I say that, yes, there's a dialogue that needs to be had, there is, but it's still really hard. Mm-hmm. It's not the first thing I want to do every morning when I wake up.
Right. No. Yeah. your kids, you know, so you had kids young. You've raised, as you said, you have a 28-year-old. You've raised now teenagers.
Yeah. I mean, I'm mid-raise on the teenagers.
You're in the mid-raise. Oh. So, but in that raising,
yeah,
have you found good friend support around the raising? Because I find that a lot of people connect through their kids, that a lot of people's relationships connect through their kids.
Yes and no. The first time around, because I was a very young mother, I didn't know any other teenage women who had kids. They were all older than me. And I did find some really wonderful friends through the child, you know, the kid connection of not knowing people and someone being like, oh, you should meet so-and-so. They have a kid your age. And yes, I did. With these two, I mean, I had twins, which is, you know, a whole other parenting approach because, you know, in my case, I was breastfeeding two babies. And I had very bad postpartum. So the combination of breastfeeding twins and then postpartum, I would say the first 2 and a bit years of their lives, I didn't really leave my house much. Mm-hmm. I was pretty housebound. And then I did have some friends that had younger kids, but not really. This second batch of babies, I don't think I've really made friends. Maybe a few of my friends had like their second kid, like I did around the same time, but not a lot. And I miss that tribe. I miss that tribe of raising kids that were the same age and being mm-hmm. able to say, oh, hey, is this going on with your kid? Because I'm seeing this, or like, what do you think about this? I've noticed my kids doing this. I didn't really have that resource with these last two that I did with the first one.
Yeah, I didn't have with my daughter, Annie. We have one set of friends, husband and a wife and their daughter, who is a week apart from our daughter. And we were put together by mutual friends saying, hey, you know, they also live where you guys live and they have a daughter. And so we made friends that way. But I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't feel that. I look at my friend Leah Michelle now, and, you know, she and Emma Roberts just had a baby, and Billy Lord just had a baby, and they're all friends, and they all have their babies together.
But they're the right age as well.
Right. And they,
I just saw Emma the other day.
Right. I mean, it's just spectacular. And I did not have that.
Right. They're in their 20s. So they're also at that age where, I was 19 when I had Atlanta. And then I was 34 when I had Ella and Sylvan. And so, you know, it was an interesting thing. Like 19 was pretty young to be having a kid. And then 34, I mean, a lot of people have had their babies, you know, mm-hmm. by that point. So I kind of had them at non-traditional times to be having babies, you know. One of the unfortunate things that I think about a lot is that for women, our peak earning years match up with our peak fertile years. And so, you know, all those three women that you just mentioned, they all have baller jobs, right?
Yeah.
They're successful women and they're having kids in their 20s at the time that their careers are at their peak as well. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I tried to do it kind of before, and I don't want to say after, I tried to kind of do it on either side of it because I know the challenges of working and being a mom and having kids at that really peak crazy time of creativity where there's a lot of demands on you.
What do you go to your good friends with? Like, I obviously you're married and you have, as you said, kids that are sort of varying teens and then a 28-year-old. Are your mother and father alive?
They are, and I don't really have a relationship with them. So my mom or I have a, you know, strained relationship with them. My mom lives in the UK. Unfortunately, I left the UK when I was 20 because I was so traumatized from being a young person who was, you know, severely bullied by the tabloid media to the point where my mental health suffered so greatly that I had to leave. And I left the UK with one piece of luggage, my husband at the time, and I left my entire 4-story brownstone in Notting Hill Gate with food in the fridge and laundry in the hamper, and I never went back. That's how traumatized I was. And it took me years and years and years to recovery to be able to go back to the UK and not, you know, have a complete regression in my mental health. Because as a young person growing up there, when you are the victim and the focus of the salacious and vicious British tabloid media, you don't stand a chance. And so unfortunately, my mom, you know, still lives there, but I do not care for being there. And it has been a real shame that I've not been able to, obviously, I've grown and changed a lot since when I fled the UK at age 20, but I haven't been able to restructure a relationship with her, because the last time I lived there, you know, I was, you know, 19, 20. Yeah. So I don't have a very strong relationship with her. And my dad is here and the UK, but is also, you know, has been traveling my whole life and has never really been in one fixed abode, and is, you know, started my love for unavailable men, you know, young, you know, trained me how to do it. And so it's, you know, my friends have been my chosen family, and they are very, very important to me. And I have been raised by, you know, I've been raised by them. And I hope that I help raise them in some ways. Mm-hmm. I very much believe in kind of multi-generational friendships. I think that a woman, actually my interview series, The Conversation, I would have Jane Fonda and Miley Cyrus on the same episode. And the network would argue with me and say, well, this is just two different audiences. I'm like, why? Why can't Miley Cyrus fans get exposed to Jane Fonda and realize what a baller woman she is? Mm. You know, and by the way, women of a certain age they don't have an expiration date. I don't want to put women away once they hit 35 or 40. The wisdom that comes with women who are older, I value and I appreciate, and I want to highlight the wisdom of age. And it's something that our culture is not particularly interested in. And so I always try to do that, where I have friends who are older and younger, and I continue to learn from all of them, because, you know, they have invaluable and different perspectives. So, you know, I would say I have certain people that I go to for certain things, right?
Sure.
You know, there are friendships, you know, my friend Amber, who I've been friends with for 25 years, and we've seen each other grow up, and I've seen her be married and divorced and have a grown-up son. And, you know, my friend Demi, who is a few years older than me, and, you know, she raises daughters, and I've seen her go through a marriage and a divorce and raising kids. And you know, it's such an honor. It's such an honor to bear witness to your friends' lives. You know, my friend Victoria, who at age, you know, 45, became one of the most celebrated female directors that there is today. You know, when we all thought, Jesus, is this woman ever going to get a break? It's like to watch my friends, and I've known her 30 years. So to watch my friends go through different stages of life, and to be able to be trusted enough to witness their journey and their intimate journey is the most profound gift for me. It's the most profound gift that I get to look at them and know, oh my God, I've seen you at your most vulnerable. I have seen you on the floor. I have had the blessing of being able to put my hand down to you and help you up and hug you and love you until you could stand up straight again. And by the way, you've done that for me. You have seen me in that place, you know, and you just have a love, appreciation for, you know, for the journey that we're on. And so grateful that I've had these friends that have trusted me to let themselves be seen, because that is the ultimate honor, in my opinion.
Well, here's what I'll say to you. I would have been terrified of you in high school, terrified, but I would have come up to you like an exotic animal and kind of want, I would have tried to get close just to be in the orbit of the exotic animal before I would have run away, because you would have said, let's go break a rule. And I would have been like, no, I can't.
I can't
break rules. I would have had fun, but I would have been petrified and it would have just given me agita. But ultimately, I think as I started to develop my own mind, my way of thinking and looking at the world, and I would have absolutely walked up to you, regardless of being 10 years or 20 years older than you, and saying, I want to know you. I know I would have said, I want to know you. And I would have risked the challenge of you to someone like me, a good girl who didn't break rules. I would have risked it for you, because you have the same level of integrity that I hope I have. I think I've seen that in you, and I would have been like, I'm terrified, but I want to be your good friend. And I'm so glad that you were here today. Thank you so much. And I hope my listener had some fun and listened and learned about bravery and all sorts of things. And if you're out there, listeners, stay safe. God bless you. Be well. And Amanda Decadene, thank you so much for being a good friend on the Good Friend Podcast with me. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, one listener.
Good Friend is produced by Dylan Fagan and is a production of iHeartRadio. Our theme song, Good Friend, is written, produced, and performed by Emily King.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.